This is Jason Snell sitting in for Leo. We've got a great tweet for you today. Some wonderful guests, Harry McCracken, Carolina Milanese, and Andy Anatko. We're going to talk about Apple. We're going to talk about YouTube. We're going to talk about wearables that you put in your ears. And I'm going to scare you with terrifying stories of terrible internet security. It's all next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
It's This Week in Tech, episode 713, recorded April 7th, 2019. Earables.
This Week in Tech is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use invoicing and accounting software. If you don't believe me, try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/twit. And by LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Just remember your master password and let LastPass remember the rest. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more. And by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Visit Capterra's free website at Capterra.com/twit. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free.
Welcome back to Twit This Week in Tech. I am not Leo Laporte. Leo is on vacation. I should say on assignment. That's how they're supposed to do it professional-like. Leo is on assignment in Hawaii, probably on a beach somewhere. But I am here to squire you through this week in technology's biggest stories, and I have a wonderful group of people here with me. To my left, in person here at the Twit Studios, is my old counterpart. When I was Mr. Macworld, he was Mr. PC World from Fast Company. It's Harry McCracken. Hi, Harry.
Hey, Jason. Good
to Thank
be
you
here.
So much for joining me on my fill-in episode of Twit. Also have somebody I've known for, it's a very large number of years, my friend from all the way back in Mac User Magazine, which has not been published for more than 20 years. It's Andy Anatko. Hello, Andy.
Hello. As I, every time you bring that up, I have to tell people we've known each other for so long that Jason is the person who taught me how to boldface text in HTML.
That's right. Back when we did HTML in like text editors, because there were no tools for HTML, because nobody knew what the web was. And somebody I've not known for too long, although I have had her on many podcasts over the last few years. She is so smart at technology stuff from Creative Strategies. It's Carolina Milanese. Hello.
Hi there.
Do a video podcast show thing.
I know. I need to remember that the camera is on so I don't embarrass myself too much.
We're watching. We're always watching. that was a little too creepy, but we'll get to our scary security stories at the end of the show. I want to start talking about services and Apple just because it's sort of been one of the stories of the last couple of weeks. Apple's spent a couple of years telling everybody, in Wall Street at least, that services are very important to the future growth of Apple. We've gotten some details, obviously, at their media event a couple of weeks ago. And, some interesting stuff going on in terms of the story behind the story about Apple's News Plus service. They have made some deals with the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and, of course, a bunch of magazines. And there was a piece in the New York Times this week about the behind the scenes a little bit. Media companies taking a big gamble on Apple. Apple obviously put the hard press on the Times and Washington Post. Didn't work out. But a lot of magazines are concerned about their business model, as Harry and I and Andy, as magazine veterans, can attest. What is a magazine, you might ask? And I think it's really interesting to see Apple's pitch to these other media companies and the ones who say yes and the ones who say no and the ones who are like, well, this sounds like a bad idea, but Apple's so big and they have so much money. Maybe we should just see what happens, which is not a great business model, I got to say. But I can kind of understand that if you're a magazine, you might throw your lot in with Apple and hope for the best. Harry, you've been doing magazines. You did it before I did, I think. When you read these stories, what do you think about how the magazine industry is handling this with Apple?
Well, it's intriguing partially because I've used Texture for a long time, Texture being this magazine app that Apple bought as the foundation for the new News Plus. And Texture, for $10 or $15 a month, has offered you virtually every magazine you've ever heard of, and competes directly with the individual apps of all those magazines, which tend to maybe cost $10 a month or at least a few dollars a month on their own. And Texture was originally essentially started by a consortium of the magazine industry and was seen as a possible savior. It was the Netflix of magazines. Mm-hmm. And apparently got about a couple of 100,000 paying subscribers. So not nothing, but also not huge numbers of people. And apparently Apple, in the couple of weeks since they announced News Plus, has 200,000 subscribers. Now, they're getting a free trial, so we don't know what that will boil down to when people start paying. But the mere fact it's Apple makes it scary in a way that something rather similar, not controlled by Apple, did not scare the magazine industry for the last 6 or 7 years.
There might be some fear of success, too, because yes. If this is successful, then the business model becomes everybody's just sort of in on Apple's platform, and right. You're taking a percentage of a percentage of a percentage to get whatever your cut is.
Texture was never going to have like millions and millions and millions of subscribers, and Apple News Plus, maybe it will at some point. I do sort of feel, though, that like Apple News Plus is still very magazine-centric and about things, a lot of what you're in magazine layouts, and they come out once a week or once a month. And I feel like that's never going to change the industry that much or probably destroy the industry, just because when all is said and done, it's a rather old school way to consume content these days. And I'm not sure how compelling it is. I happily pay for it, partially because I can look up stuff I've written on dead trees. But for normal people, I don't see like magazines on an iPhone as being unbelievably compelling and the kind of thing that will destroy magazines as we've known them.
Andy, what do you think about this as a veteran of magazines, of dead trees? I have many words on dead trees. You have many words on dead trees.
Yeah, well, darn those trees. They had it coming. I'm just glad we were able to get our little shivs in while we had the chance. I'm just not really impressed with News Plus at all. I just think that for one thing, the deal that Apple is offering all these publications, particularly the heavy pitches that they're making to newspapers, is really, really weak sauce. They seem to be saying, we won't hurt you if you come and join us. And they're trying to say, we will give you chicken feed. And but that's more than having chicken feed is better than having absolutely nothing, isn't it? Whereas every time I talk to somebody who is managing either a large paper or a small paper, and you can define newspaper as any outfit that does journalism that affects one region, as opposed to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, they keep saying that they're not terribly afraid of the future, because most of what they have been learning to do traditionally is to have this relationship with their readers. And by readers, they mean communities. So it's not just trying to optimize for clicks. It's trying to figure out that, wow, our local political coverage for some reason has really gone up in the past year and a half. We're going to put a lot more of our resources into that part of our coverage. Or we would have gotten a lot more play for this article, a lot more reads for this article, had we released it on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, which is data that they have access to if they are just running things throughout their own sites. Certainly having subscriptions through their own readership to get access to premium content, like, you know, more than 10 articles per month, that's dicey, but it's very much in the tradition that they've been in, the business they've been in for years and years and years. Again, the relationship between the publication and the readers. And Apple is absolutely denying this. They're making sure that I don't have a relationship with the Boston Globe. I will have a relationship with Apple, and Apple will be responsible for creating a conduit between my eyeballs and the Boston Globe's content. And if the Globe wants to figure out that, wow, I didn't know that we had Andy lives like way outside of Boston. I didn't know that we had so many readers that were in that part of New England. They are not going to figure that out, because Apple's going to keep that stuff that stuff separate, that information private. And lastly, just the app itself, it really doesn't feel like a newspaper, and it doesn't feel like even like a digital news app like Google News. It feels like the Kindle app, where I can go to this, I can tap on this button and read this book called National Geographic Magazine, or read this book called The Wall Street Journal. It just doesn't feel relevant to the way that even I, a Generation Xer, let alone millennials, actually interact with news these days. So I'm just not impressed. It's pretty weak sauce.
I will point out one of the ways that organizations can gather information about the readers in Apple News is to aggressively add newsletter links to their stories. And if you've ever read one of those Wall Street Journal stories in News Plus, boy, there's always a What's News newsletter sign up in there because they want to know who you are, because they don't know because you're an Apple News Plus subscriber and that's not, you're not their customer yet, but they want to find a way to convert you somehow and then upsell you on the full on journal. Carolina, what do you think about Apple News Plus as a service? You know, does it make business sense for anybody? Does it? Who does this service make sense for? Is it? Does it make sense for Apple? Does it make sense for publishers?
Well, Apple is having a second go at this, right? They had Newsstand before, and that wasn't a successful service. I think the beginning of News Plus seems to suffer from a similar issue, which is what Andy was talking about, the fact that a lot of the content is not being optimized for digital consumption. And so you have a subpar experience compared to what you would get if you buy a real magazine. The feel that Harry was talking about when you're going through the glossy pages and you see the layout, and it's very different to read a magazine, the reasons behind buying a magazine and a newspaper. You know, with a newspaper or a book, you want the information, the layout is somewhat less important than a magazine. And it was interesting to see that they highlighted some of the magazines that work with Apple in taking advantage of the digital format. That is really where I think the providers will get new readers. And so to the benefit is, I think, is expanding your audience. And so making that experience appealing to millennials and Gen Zs that, to Andy's point, are used to consume news and read articles in a different way. And or, for instance, for the Washington, the Wall Street Journal, expanding away from a core audience of, you know, Wall Street and business people that are happy to pay for a full subscription. So, you know, if you're not into that line of business, but you're still interested in getting some of the news from the Wall Street Journal, maybe, you know, the $9.99 that News Plus offers you as an alternative is more appealing to you. So expanding your audience and for Apple finding a new tie into the consumer, I see it this way. But I also get reminded by the fact that I perused all the magazines as soon as the app came out. And last week, the whole week went past and I didn't go to it once because other things take over. And so when I start having to pay for it, is $10 something that I can afford to pay if I go to it 2-3 times a month? Maybe not.
Yeah, I was thinking about the web native training that we've all gotten to. And Harry, you mentioned this, the idea that if you're only dropping new content every week or every month in an app that is kind of a glorified RSS reader, I wonder how relevant you can be. And it started me thinking that maybe the long-term goal here is for Apple to drag a lot of these magazines into a different place where they're more of a sort of a premium content behind a paywall business model than they are a monthly business model. Now, a lot of these magazines are already posting their content on the web, which conflicts with this. But it struck me when Sports Illustrated had their baseball preview issue as part of the first drop on News Plus, and I thought, well, what I really want is every time they post a baseball article to have it show up in my baseball news category. But I'm not quite sure that they've thought that through, if that's really how it's going to work. And if I have to wait and I only get those articles once a week, I'm not sure how useful it is to me.
It certainly is true that a lot of the publications on News Plus either are instituting paywalls already, and if they're not, they're at least considering it. I mean, I don't think there's a publication that doesn't want to get more money from its readers, but they like to get that money directly from their readers just because, as Andy says, they want to know who those people are, and if you get the money directly from them, it's likely to be more money. I suppose Apple's theory would be that If News Plus has a vastly larger number of readers than any single publication has, the money might work out okay. but it's yet to be seen.
Yeah, putting I think that was a lot of faith in that, in the hope that Apple will come through for them.
I'm sorry. I think that was the Wall Street Journal's point when they were talking to their own employees about why they're going with Apple News Plus, not because they felt as though they were going to lose readers to News Plus, but because in their case, they felt as though it would bring in a lot of people that weren't going to be coming to the product anyway,
right.
Which kind of makes sense because it's a really expensive subscription. And most of the people who buy it are buying it because they are in finance. They are they have some sort of business reason why they want the extra investigation and the extra analysis. So if it's okay with them if they get whatever they get from Apple News Plus for the people who are just going to be reading the news, the tech coverage or the political coverage or what have you.
Yeah, and the they're also one of the places that's got an aggressive paywall, and I think that is the other part of this story, as Harry said, that if you've got an expensive, huge subscription and then you've got a hard paywall, then something like Apple News Plus for some subset of it starts to feel good, because like I kept seeing links to Wall Street Journal articles and being like, nope, I can't read this story because I don't subscribe. Yeah. And now I can search for that story in the Wall Street Journal. And if it's within the last 3 days, I can read that story because of Apple News Plus. And that's actually a pretty great feature that only is because the journal is so hard with their paywall. So it works with the paywall, I think.
I mean, in theory, I think there might be some value to a publication like Fast Company where we're on News and News Plus. We'll probably be exposed to some people who didn't already know about us. If you discover Fast Company on News Plus and like it, I think there's a pretty good chance you will also come to our website. You might subscribe to our newsletters, which is great. You might go out and buy a print magazine. You might attend one of our conferences or listen to our podcast. If our name gets in front of people who didn't know about us already, that's useful and might be worth the gamble.
I do wonder as well how this balance between what the magazines and the papers want out of News Plus and what they want out of a direct relationship with a customer is influencing how rich the user experience on News Plus is going to be. Because right now it feels a little bit like, do you remember when the iPad came out and you had some feature apps that were designed for iPads, but most apps were still the blow it up twice, right? From the iPhone. Kind of feels that way, that you have some good examples of what News Plus could be, but the majority of the content in the app today is not being optimized. And I wonder how that balance is going to influence that. As Apple gets better with search, which at the moment is pretty poor, so you know, good luck to you in trying to go and find that article that you were looking for on the Wall Street Journal. If search gets better, if more magazines are optimizing content, I think that would be very compelling. And so does that become more of a risk for the bigger magazines and papers that already have an audience?
I will say that as somebody who pays for the New York Times and the Washington Post, I'm very happy with them being in their own little app silo. I think Apple News Plus is interesting maybe because it is the Netflix model. It's providing you with at least some variety, but that's not necessarily the same thing as having a primary news source. Speaking of news, by the way, interesting story on Recode by Peter Kafka about Facebook and Facebook's approach to news. Mark Zuckerberg said in an interview with the CEO of Axel Springer that they're thinking about creating a section of Facebook devoted to high-quality news and may pay publishers that share their stuff there. Now, this is interesting because I view this perhaps a little bit cynically as Facebook realizing, hey, maybe the people who have the best ideas of what kind of content should be surfaced from news organizations are people who spend their days thinking about what content should be surfaced at news organizations, as opposed to sort of letting the algorithm of your weird uncle churn up strange headlines.
Maybe they'd say weird aunts as well. Okay, I'm an uncle. I could be kind of weird, but so there were weird aunts too. All right.
Okay, your weird aunt and uncle and possibly grandpa or grandma, where just anybody, some strange person you knew in kindergarten who is now believes that the earth is flat and is going to. The point here is that, you know, I want to be an optimist about Facebook, and that is very, very hard to do these days. But I like the idea that Mark Zuckerberg may finally have had a realization that The way they surface news in Facebook is not necessarily the best way to get a sense of what's going on in the world. Am I wrong to be at least somewhat optimistic about a statement like this?
Well, this is not a new idea. Facebook a few years ago did an app called Paper, which was along the lines of a Flipboard or an Apple News Plus, and that the presentation was very beautiful, and it was organized much more like a newsstand with publications in their own little silos and a lot of professional content. And I loved it. I mean, when that existed, that was my primary interface to Facebook, but it didn't go much of anywhere, and they eventually killed it. And so like a lot of the things that Facebook comes up with, it's not new. In a lot of cases, it's stuff they've tried before, and they did not have the patience to stick with it.
Well, that's the challenge, right, is that Facebook's goals here, well, I mean, Facebook's goals have always been to increase engagement. That is that can lead down some very strange paths. It is true that Facebook's goal these days probably also is to stay out of trouble. And so it makes me wonder if that changes their philosophy a little bit just because of all the criticism that they've gotten. Carolina, what do you think?
I'm with you on the skepticism because it does seem to me like a way to not avoid solving their own problem with news, but kind of deflecting a bit and having a different source, a reputable source. It's interesting that he also mentioned that he's willing to pay publishers for it, and the customers are not going to be able to pay, which raises other question as far as, am I paying in another way? You know, is Facebook now going to know what I'm reading within that page, what articles I'm reading, and find out even more about me reading reputable sources of news? But it does feel a bit, why now? Why, you know, to Harry's point, they tried before and didn't stick with it. Now it seems to try and take away from all the other interesting news and sources that you mentioned. And like their suggestion about having government involved to monitor and rectify to some extent the hate speech, it seems to me they're finding other ways and putting the burden of what should be their job onto somebody else.
Andy?
Yeah, it's for one thing, anytime that Zuckerberg says he's playing on anything, I mean, I just don't think that he fundamentally understands the sense of responsibility that a company of the scale of Facebook has. I think that he really does, a part of him really does think that this is Harvard. He can still be the bad little boy who can do anything, you know, move fast, break things, without realizing that when you get to a certain scale, when you break things, you break systems and you break infrastructure and you create big, big problems. Last year, their big announcement about news was chiefly a reaction thing to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, saying that, guess what, we're not going to have quite so much news in people's news feeds anymore, which I thought that was an acknowledgement that this is getting us in trouble, the way that news feeds are manipulating people, either through our intention to sell more ads or through our inattentiveness to the problems of running this sort of service. I think it turned out that they switched it from about a 5% content of news to 4%, but okay, whatever. So I think this is them trying to dip their toe back in the water. I do like the idea of a service that's making a lot of money saying that, what if we were to actually pay for content that appears in people's news feeds so that we don't have to get them to sign up for some sort of a new ad promotion. We don't have to get news providers to set up an exclusive business arrangement with us. Just simply, we will have human beings and algorithms that are looking for fast-moving stories that require really good coverage. And as soon as we identify that, we will simply pay the Washington Post, we will pay the Boston Globe, we will pay the Lowell Sun or whatever this publication is to give it a larger audience. That's really interesting, but it will depend on how well they curate this stuff. If anything, everything we've been seeing in the past couple of months has really made me appreciate what Google News is doing, where they're trying to keep an algorithmic sort of focused approach, while at the same time realizing that they kind of screwed up by not thinking that news was quite as important as it actually is. It's not simply something that people search for. It's something that people search for with the intention of finding valid content. And if they don't find valid content, if they find someone who's saying that vaccinations cause diseases, that has an effect on society that they will then be responsible for. I really like when the Mueller report was released and went to news.google.com, and they really had like 6 different tiers from the top to the bottom. The top being here is news items related to the Mueller report's release from trusted and verified news agencies. Here are videos that again have been from trusted news agencies. Here is a timeline of the story from the start to the finish. Here are editorials that are specifically labeled as opinions and analysis, but still from trusted stories. Here's social media. And then at the very, very bottom, you get the purely algorithmic. Here is just what some joker who has a Blogspot account is saying about the Mueller report. That shows exactly how much work and also maybe how much vulnerability Google feels at being regulated back into the Stone Age if they don't take the bull by the horns in making sure that they're not weaponizing news or allowing anybody else to weaponize news for them.
There's a purely competitive aspect of this, I think, which is, you know, you mentioned Google News, something like Apple News, leaving aside even the Apple News Plus. Apple has a team of editorial people who are picking stories to do news summaries. It is, you know, I wonder if Facebook realizes that even though people use Facebook as a source of news, if it becomes or has become already such a source that everybody thinks of it as not trustworthy, that there are other sources. And then one aspect of controlling your digital life leaves Facebook's control, which is bad for Facebook. It may be too late. I don't know. But certainly something like Google News, something like Apple News, those are competitors for your time on your devices. And if they give you a better news experience than what Facebook is giving, then that's bad for Facebook. At least
Facebook is a casino where they got to keep you inside the casino. They got to keep you gambling. If you leave that place to go to a hotel room or to go to a restaurant, that's time in which you're not being observed. You're not being controlled. So if they can make sure that you're not tempted to leave Facebook for Apple News or for Google News and get your news directly from Facebook, again, that makes you within the walled garden of Facebook and therefore valuable and of use to the mothership.
All right. We have much more to talk about. We're going to talk about 5G. Apple may have painted itself in a corner when it comes to supporting 5G on the iPhone. Lots of interesting stuff about wearables in your ears, or should we call them hearables? I say we should not. And there's some more stuff. Google, YouTube. We got more security stories to terrify you. All of that is coming next. But first, I sense far away from a beach somewhere that Leo Laporte is demanding that we take a break to let you hear about one of our sponsors, Leo.
Thank you, Jason, for doing Twit for me. I really appreciate it. We'll get back to the show in just a second. But first, as they say, a word from our sponsor, FreshBooks. They want me to do the ads for FreshBooks because I use FreshBooks. In fact, FreshBooks saved my life. I love FreshBooks. Back when I was working up in Toronto for a call for help, I had to invoice in Canadian dollars plus do expenses, and I would put it off and put it off. FreshBooks was such a relief. FreshBooks starts by making it easy to invoice. Really easy. You do it all online. You send it by email. But you also can import expenses with the FreshBooks app on your smartphone. You just take a picture of the receipts. It goes right into the invoice or just into your books. So you always know your expenses. You always have a record of everything very easily. It also has a Pay Me Now button. As soon as you start using FreshBooks, you can start accepting online payments. And it turns out by doing that, you're going to get paid, on average, twice as fast. Clients love it. FreshBooks is a web app, so it's always getting better, always getting new features. They just added ACH payments, bank transfers, you know, automated clearinghouse, ACH. That's a network that connects all the financial institutions across the United States. It's fast. You get paid twice as fast. It's great for large invoices. People don't want to write big checks on those amounts. And it's inexpensive. There's a 1% transaction fee. But that's an example of them always adding new features to FreshBooks. I've been using it for, I started using it 2004, I think, a long time ago. And it's just gotten better and better and better. Frankly, FreshBooks essentially is doing accounting simply by creating and customizing invoices, logging your hours with time tracking, scheduling payments, categorizing expenses. They've got the books done. You're ready when tax time comes, and I know it's coming. It's too late for this year, right? But next year, you'll be glad you started using FreshBooks. And there's lots of easy-to-understand reports. You'll know, for instance, something I never knew as a freelancer until I started using FreshBooks, whether you've made money yet. You'll know any moment in time. Are you in profit? If you're a hardworking small business owner, you know that it's important to focus on what you do best and let FreshBooks do the rest. It's a relief. You will love it. And you can try it free right now for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/twit. 24 million people. That can't be. Is that right? 24 million people have used FreshBooks now. Wow. I was the first practically. FreshBooks.com/twit. If you do me a favor, we really are. We love FreshBooks. They've been a supporter for so long of our shows. And we thank them for that. But you can support us in return by using that special URL, FreshBooks.com/twit. You'll get 30 days free. Just put This Week in Tech in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's how you show your support for Twit. Help us stay alive. And thank you, FreshBooks. We really appreciate your support. FreshBooks.com/twit. Put This Week in Tech in that box so you get your 30 days free. Back to the show.
I love the taste of fresh books in the morning. Wait, and that's why they don't let me read the ads. Let's talk about 5G. Got to talk about 5G now. Rolling out slowly. It's an interesting thing. Cellular networks going up to 5G. Apple and the iPhone, it's already been reported they are unlikely to release a 5G iPhone in 2019. But everybody thought, well, 2020. That'll probably be okay. That's a long way off, the fall of 2020, but they might be able to make it. And now we've been hearing some things about Apple's attempts to get 5G in 2020. And as Mark Sullivan, who Harry and I used to work with and who works with Harry at Fast Company now, he reports, not so fast. Maybe that will be a shaky plan too, because Intel may or may not be able to get enough of its 5G modems to Apple for Apple to test and for Apple to put in their iPhones in the fall of 2020, remind you again, not this fall, next fall. And Apple, meanwhile, is also staffing up a new chip division to presumably build modems for their mobile devices going forward. How do we know this? Partially, it's because they are hiring lots of people in San Diego, basically across the street from Qualcomm. suspicious. So, Harry, this is a story that originated with Fast Company.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really great story where Mark really lays down that Apple has painted itself into a corner with all of its lawsuits with Qualcomm and right. Then now having to count on Intel to provide a 5G modem.
Yeah, I mean, for anybody else, Qualcomm would be a very logical provider of this mm-hmm. modem, but the legal war between Qualcomm and Apple is really one of the most bitter ones I can remember. I mean, I think it's way worse than something like when Apple and Samsung were at odds with each other. At the same time, they're also doing business together. And Intel really wants to have a modem business. They are building these fabs to build modem chips, which need to be paid for, and having a nice large customer like Apple, which they already do, for LTE modems is appealing to them.
Right. If you have an iPhone XS or a XR, there's an Intel modem in
right.
there now. But they haven't come out with a 5G modem yet.
And, you know, Mark's story says that Intel is having issues hitting these deadlines. Apple is a famously difficult customer. They set very demanding deadlines. They're not going to give you a vast profit margin on the modems you're making for them. If you start to blow those deadlines, I don't think they're terribly forgiving. And then Apple doesn't have a lot of options. They'll have an option someday, presumably, because they will be able to make their own modems. But even if they hire twice as many 5G modem engineers, that doesn't mean they can cut their timetable in half. That pretty clearly is something for 2021 or beyond.
And Intel has a new CEO as well, who, according to Mark's story, has possibly been saying, why are we bending over backwards to take care of these guys?
Right.
Is this really a good business that we need to have Apple as our client here? I don't know.
And it is okay in some ways, just because you mentioned the CNET story by Jessica Dolkart, where she went out and tried a 5G modem phone in Chicago, and it ranged from really good to really terrible randomly. So there's no reason for anybody to rush out and buy a 5G modem today or in 6 months. And if Apple does get a 5G phone out a year and a half from now, that does feel like it's probably pretty good timing. By then, the networks will be out there, and they'll probably work pretty well. And it's classic Apple to not to have the first 5G phone, but to have the 5G phone that arrives when it makes sense. But 2021 would be really late, most likely.
That's pretty late. Yeah, it's a great story on CNET by Jessica Dolkart about, I think the one of the headlines was it literally brought me to tears, and not necessarily the good kind, and going back and forth. 5G is kind of not real right now, but I think the question is, like as Harry said, by the fall of 2020, it will be maybe a lot harder to stand up on a stage and say, we still can't do 5G, right? Mm-hmm.
I think that so long as they can stand on the stage and say that we will have 5G by this date, because there's so many problems in getting 5G deployed. This is nothing like there's nothing like 3G and 4G. There's nothing like LTE. This really is. All these providers are going to have to build out an entirely new network. We're not talking about just adding new cell sites or adding new software or adding new gear to existing sites. It's totally new. It's very, very short throw. It's very, very susceptible to you can't really bounce signals off of standing structures like you can with LTE. The difference in speed is it's going to be a while until services and mobile devices are spry enough to make you appreciate that extra speed. And the other thing is that it's not just getting these modem chips to work. It's also getting antenna systems on mobile devices to work, because, again, this has been a solved problem for 3G and 4G LTE networks. Remember how much trouble Apple got in when they tried to do a clever antenna design and they realized that it really wasn't that easy 5 or 6 years ago when they were creating the new iPhone, the antenna gate, you're holding it wrong sort of thing. Well, with every single manufacturer is probably going to go through their own version of antenna gate for the next year or two, trying to figure out how do you get these 5G antennas to always find a signal when a signal is present, whilst also having antennas that are going to be compatible with 4G and LTE. So I think that a lot of these companies have a lot of time before it starts to look embarrassing. Apple certainly has the ability to simply say, well, if you're unhappy with your super fast LTE speed and you are upset with us because the 5G network, which probably isn't available in your area yet and won't be for another year, and doesn't actually deliver the sort of features that you're hoping to get from 5G, if that's enough for you to leave all of your iOS services and apps to go to Android, good luck with that. So Apple certainly is not really on the hook there. But the whole point of this article is really important, where you have Intel, which doesn't have the capability yet to create modem chips as well as Qualcomm can create modem chips. And meanwhile, there is a certain amount of two middle-aged people across a table from each other with squinty eyes, Apple and Qualcomm, saying, I'd rather set our company on fire than buy our chips from you. Yeah, well, I'd rather shoot myself in the head right here and now than sell you chips. It really is getting nasty and personal between these two companies. So for those of us who aren't invested in either of these two companies, it's going to be fun to watch.
It really depends how late Intel really is, right? Because the timeline was supposed to be first half of 2020, which usually when you say first half in tech means June, never means January, right? And that would have already put some pressure for Apple to do a September launch, which is what we've been accustomed to for the iPhone. If Intel is only, say, a couple of months late, you could envision a scenario whereby Apple does the usual September launch without a 5G, and so without a flagship iPhone, because I very much doubt that Apple will come in and put 5G on all the phones, right? So you're going to have a flagship product with 5G and the rest will not. So they could stagger that launch as long as the 5G can happen in Q1 of 2021. Now, if Intel is very late, you are looking at further into 2021. I agree with both Andy and Harry that, of course, there's still a lot of teething issues with deployment. And even when things are going to go well, it's not going to be everywhere, right? So depending where you are located, you might be interested or not. But we also have to think that with phones, we have seen a longer replacement cycle, which means that if I'm investing in something in 2020, I do think ahead and I do want to be ready for when 5G will come to wherever I live or when, you know, the connectivity gets better. And that's the part that I think that Apple needs to think about is, you know, one, will it defer upgrades? And so will people wait till they have 5G and or will people be concerned about the lack of 5G and decide not to wait and go somewhere else? I also agree with Andy that it's not been for quite some time that you don't just think of the phone in isolation. You know, if you're an iPhone user and you are deep into the ecosystem, moving to Android has other ramifications, not just I'm moving with my phone, but is, you know, what else, what other devices do I have, what services I am bringing. And so, you know, going back to what we were discussing before about News Plus, but also TV and the credit card that Apple is bringing in all this year, all those things will tie consumers into the Apple ecosystem even more. So, you know, will they have to just suck it up and wait? Maybe.
I keep thinking of summer of 2020, and follow me here. There's an ad from Samsung in the summer of 2020. I mean, they could do it now, but they definitely, let's give them a year. That is, here is how fast the Samsung 5G phone is, and here is how slow the flagship iPhone is, and this is why you should buy a Samsung. I think the marketing will be out there because if you've got an advantage, why not press it? I think the real question is, will consumers really care about 5G? Will the marketing make them care about something that may not really have an impact on them? Because I am very skeptical of whether 5G as a technology is really going to make a difference for most consumers. It is going to make differences in like other categories for other kinds of devices. We've seen demos with like hospitals and all of that, but you've got to be in a 5G area. Those 5G areas may be spotty. And do you really need, are there applications that you will really, you know, stretch your bandwidth to the point where you need 5G instead of 4G? I'm skeptical of that, but it may not matter if consumers think they need it and think they can't get it from Apple. I think that's Apple's weakness in the short term.
It's going to be great for things like cars. Cars are going to be able to suck up a lot more data, which they will need if they're going to be driving themselves. And on phones, it might be kind of a nice to have rather than something transformative.
We talk about Intel. I just want to point out, Andy's got this argument about the two men across the table from each other. Like, all right, I'm never, ever, ever going to make a deal with you. Then Apple turns around and there's another table with Intel. And Apple says, I really need those modems, but in 2 years, I won't use you as a supplier anymore, right? Because everybody knows that Apple is not going to use Intel as a modem supplier in the long run. They're going to make their own. So,
it's also a question of whether Intel is actually interested in keeping that business going or not, not just because Apple might or might not be a difficult customer, but because, you know, they have a new CEO. And I think that Bob Swan has questioned whether being in the modem business period is a good thing for Intel.
Mm. Okay. I think Carolina made a great point a little while ago. In which people are holding on to their phones longer for more and more years than they used to 5 or 10 years ago, where I think the cycle of, hey, I've this phone that I have is working perfectly fine, but it's 2 years old now. I'd much rather have the new phone now. People are holding on for 3, 4, 5 years sometimes. So if someone has dropped their phone or if someone really wants whatever that really cool new triple face ID feature is, they don't really care about 5G, but maybe in 3 years' time during the lifespan of that phone when 5G is actually a practical thing. They don't want to have to buy a brand new phone again simply because the phone that they bought in 2019 or 2020 is not 5G compatible. So I wonder if Apple could do something, would be even so bold as have a, on their really, really high-end phone, have a 5G chip and a 5G antenna that was LTE down compatible, but leave that switched off so that they will say, oh, it's you've got the hardware, it'll just be a firmware upgrade when we're ready to enable it. We want to make sure that our 5G implementation doesn't jump the gun, unlike the Samsung phone, which is causing birds and small creatures within an 80 feet radius to convulse and die because they didn't do their radios correctly. But at some, you will not have to buy a brand new phone to get 5G. It's just not going to be switched on until we switch on 5G service for the entire Apple ecosystem. It's an interesting thing to think about.
All right. Let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about something that is, again, Apple related. I swear we're almost done with my Apple queue here, but it's, you know, I'm going to talk about Apple a little bit. But Amazon relates to this too, and it's about wearables and especially growth in the wireless headphones market, really. There was a study that referred to it as the hearables market. I think that is a terrible name. Do not call them hearables. They're just things that you stick in your ears. They're wearables, and you wear them in your ears. So Apple released the AirPods 2, and they announced this week through their Beats sub-brand that they're going to do a Power Beats Pro, which is a different set of, again, little earbuds that you stick in your ears. Those are more sporty. And then there is Amazon, which Bloomberg reports is making a rival to AirPods as the first wearable. Also, I want to throw out there for discussion a fantastic story by Brian Chen in the New York Times called, basically AirPods are great, but they also don't last, which is true as we found out about 2 years in to having AirPods. Everybody's AirPod batteries are dying because look at them. They're so small. The batteries inside there are incredibly small and batteries wear out. I love my AirPods, but there's no denying that after a couple of years, they are on their last legs. So pros and cons of the hearables market. I think it's really interesting that Amazon's getting into this space. I think Apple obviously thinks there's a huge opportunity here. So therefore, the Beats as well as the AirPods themselves. Carolina, you know, what does this market look like to you? Is this a market ripe for explosion in terms of growth? Is that why Amazon is coming in here?
I think it's a market that is very strictly linked to the rise of the assistants, right? And so this digital assistant that is supposed to whisper in your ear useful stuff to you as you go by your day, not just about listening to music. We've been listening to music for longer than I can remember on a phone, and you've used different type of headsets for that or getting your call. But the fact that you have now always something in your ear, and that's why some people have started calling it more the earable market, because you have that sense of a wearable device that is no longer an accessory, but it is a device that you think a lot of when you're purchasing because you always have it with you, you wear it all day, it does different things for you. And for Amazon, I think is a way to take out of the home and hopefully in a creating more of a relationship with the user. The experience on the phone through the it's not great. There are so many different steps that you have to take. And as I speak, I can see all sorts of lights going on because I forgot to mute it. But the idea that now you have her in your ear and you can have more of a direct relationship is very important to them. And so I think is for every vendor, including Google. They tried before with the Pixel Buds and they've not been particularly successful. So hopefully the second generation will be better. But we all get in there, and it's part of what ambient computing will be, where you're going to have other devices other than your phone that will have data and will be connected. And so having earables, having buds that you have with you linked to those devices is going to be more and more important.
If we're cited in the dictionary defining when hearables became a thing, I'm going to be very upset with all of us. That's all I'm saying.
I think Christina, the H is unnecessary. I think she found the problem there. It's earables now.
Earables.
Yes.
Earables. So, yeah. Yeah, Harry, thoughts about that? I mean, I love my AirPods. I think there's something there, right?
Oh, I mean, totally. Although I love my AirPods, but I never use Siri on them. I mean, as of right now, they're just
same
really nice wireless headphones. But I think there clearly is a future for these devices becoming smarter and starting to become little computing devices. And Apple is already well positioned for that future because a very high percentage of iPhone users either have AirPods or would like to have AirPods. It's a little bit tougher for Amazon simply because they do not control a phone platform, the Fire Phone, having gone nowhere. And Apple has the advantages of being able to do an extra level of integration with an iPhone that certainly helps with making the connection smooth. And Amazon will have to rely on whatever it can do over plain vanilla Bluetooth. I think Amazon also, on the other hand, does have the potential to do something that's a lot cheaper than the AirPods. Amazon is completely happy to sell you something and make little or no money, or maybe even lose a little money to get it out there in a way that Apple, generally speaking, does not want to do. And if Amazon had something well done at like $99, sounds like a pretty cool product, and it's certainly a good way to get more people using on devices other than speakers.
Yes. Amazon products are always kind of their own separate thing because we forget that Amazon, when they get into a market, they have had the opportunity for the past 5 years to watch other people shop for this exact same product. So if they're getting into it, it might not just be an idea that they want to expand the reach of their Alyosha personal assistant. I don't want everyone to activate their devices, so I always call it Alyosha. They realize that there's a lot of money to be made in these totally cordless Bluetooth headphones. Let's make our own. And it would be nice if we could also use it to kind of make our voice assistant a little bit more present in people's lives. But that's they don't have the sort of reach that Google or Apple has right now. But I really do think that earables... there's just no other way to say it. Like
better.
we're gonna call it the iWatch because it's just a better name. Okay, I'm sorry. I think that's a very very fruitful sort of avenue for personal assistants to go into. We always envision the idea of a augmented reality device that is visual in nature. But how do you find a way to get people to put something on their faces that can actually deliver that kind of information in a handy way without making you look like a total dork? Just the problem of if you can put this into a pair of regular glasses, well, that's fine for people like us who actually wear glasses all day long. But what about people who don't? But when you have the idea of you can have an earpiece in just one ear, and you can have an assistant that will simply, as the day goes by, give you reminders or listen to cues for you to give you some information or take notes, then that in itself is really, really super useful. Now, imagine a scenario like remember the movie with Joaquin Phoenix, Her,
yeah.
A few years ago. So it's about a very, very like a next generation sort of personal assistant. So that the personal assistant can see like your environment. Joaquin Phoenix like puts a safety pin in his chest pocket so that when he puts a phone in his pocket, the camera is sort of peeking up over the margin. So imagine something like that where you can wear your phone like either in a pouch around your neck or even have like a Google Clips type little clip on camera somewhere just to give your personal assistant eyes on the world around you. And imagine you're navigating through and someone says, "Hey, Andy, it's great to see you again." And your personal assistant says, "That's Jason Snell. You've known him since about 1990. Like, "Ah, Jason, how are you, Snell? And your wife and your two kids."
It's great to see you. Andy, yes, Andy, old friend.
And no one
needs to know.
And that article I owe you is already in the Dropbox. Mm-hmm, I already remembered
sure.
that. But it's a way to put that sort of stuff in a way that doesn't distract you from your interactions with human beings, but still gives you information like that red building. If you turn to your left, is the building where you're having your meeting in 10 minutes. That's the sort of stuff that is super super exciting, and it's not an impossible thing for anybody to pull off. We have at least the material technology to make it happen. So if Amazon's not going to get there with it, but it does show how important it is that Apple still works on this and Google still works on this.
And yeah, I agree with you that we're not very far off, and yet it feels still years and years and years away, right? To the point that Harry was saying, he doesn't use Siri. It's not because of AirPods that you don't use Siri. It's because of Siri that you don't use Siri. and that's a reality. And I think if you look at the ability of, you know, putting together what you know about me and being on me and being linked to a camera, there's so much more that you could do even just today that is not being done, because it's not easy. And I think, you know, we'll talk about scary things later on in the program, but a lot of it is linked to privacy and people that you have around you that might not actually be signed up to see what you see and hear what you hear and be involved in what you are recording and happy to share with your assistant. And I think that moving from the home to the world is going to be a big challenge for Amazon, because things are different. There are so many variables in the real world that makes it harder for any assistant to be useful, because there's so much more that we need to take into account. But one fascinating thing for me, when specifically we're talking about AirPods, is to see, and maybe this is a clue to how important this segment in the market will be, is to see how similar to the iPod, this product doesn't seem to have a barrier of age, gender, income. You see people wearing AirPods that come from all sorts of, you know, walk of life. And I think that that's fascinating, because they are not, you know, they're expensive.
Yeah, it is. It has been one of Apple's most successful products of the last few years, and I think rightly so. I love this product category too. I think it's great. I think I feel like our software, our virtual assistants, are really letting the hardware down. So I guess it's time for the software to catch up, because I really love the hardware, but the software, I don't even bother talking to it like Harry. Because I don't like what it has to say. We have much more coming up on Twit. We're going to talk about Google and YouTube and scary things from security, as has been foretold. It's like I'm in a Halloween episode. Spooky security stories are coming. But first, Leo is going to be here to tell you about our next sponsor.
We'll have more with Jason Snell and friends on This Week in Tech. Sorry I can't be here. I'm in Hawaii, but I had to. I had to do this ad because I am such a massive fan of LastPass, and I think you know this. I've been talking it up for 10 years since they started, and I started using them then. I had used other password managers. There's nothing better than LastPass, and in fact, my faith in LastPass was justified not too long ago when Steve Gibson interviewed Joe Segrest, the creator. Joe shared the source code, explained exactly what they're doing, and Steve said, "This is it. This is the right way to do a password manager." It's gotten better and better ever since. Steve Gibson uses it. I use it. Your business should use it. We've been using LastPass Enterprise at Twit for a long time, ever since one of our employees, I laugh now, it was painful at the time, put all his passwords in a public website because he couldn't remember them. It's like, oh, we need LastPass. I'd been using it, so it was like, of course. And Russell agrees, by the way. Russell, our IT guy, was quick to set it up. He manages it. He likes it because he, as the IT guy, because he gets over 100 policies that he can enforce to make sure that our business passwords are super secure. For instance, we require two-factor authentication. The employees have to use it, whether they like it or not. We have minimum requirements for their password. It's got to be good. Password resets, too, because they keep forgetting. Things like that. It is the best way to manage your passwords in a business. In fact, you can even make it that, the people who have to log in to our bank accounts don't actually get the bank account password. They just get, they open LastPass, click the link to the bank. It opens up for them. After it sends an authenticator message, they say approve, deny on that LastPass authenticator. They say approve, and then it logs in for them. They never see the password, which is good because research shows that most employees, more than half, share passwords, and not just with other employees, but with other people outside the company. You don't want that. You really don't want that. LastPass is true, trust no one, encrypted end-to-end. That means it's only decrypted on the device, and every device is supported. Windows, Mac, iOS, Android. I use it on Linux, too. Every browser, Chrome, Firefox, Safari, Opera, you have plugins. Automatic fill-in on iOS and Android means it's the first app I install when I get a new phone, because it makes setting up the rest of the apps a snap. It automatically fills in the password and I log in. It's great for families, too, by the way. We use LastPass families at home because you can share passwords for things like medical accounts, credit cards, entertainment. Lisa always needs, like, the Comcast login. So I share that with her automatically, and if I update it, it gets updated automatically. It's really a great way to do it. It also has a feature I really appreciate called emergency access. I know we don't want to talk about that, but if I should become disabled or die, she gets access to the LastPass after some checks, you know. And that's really important. You don't want to just leave your family holding the bag. They can't get in your accounts or anything. LastPass has got it all figured out. And I just send when I get a new account, I send an invitation to Lisa. She gets the account shared with her. Couldn't be better. That's LastPass families. If you have a small business, LastPass Teams is fantastic. Teams of 50 or fewer. Individuals use LastPass Premium. That's what I used for years until I got married. And then we used families. And then for the business, we use LastPass Enterprise. There's a LastPass that's right for you. Join the 13.5 million people who use LastPass. It's the number one most preferred password manager. It's the one I use. And if you do nothing else today, secure your stuff. And by the way, what is it they say in the airplane? Put your mask on your face before you help others. Get LastPass, but then help others. Tell friends, family, business partners. You gotta have LastPass. It just solves it. LastPass.com/twit. LastPass.com/twit. You can tell them that URL too. That's a way of supporting our network just as LastPass does. LastPass.com/twit. We thank you and we thank them. And I send you back to Jason Snell and Twit. Go ahead, Jason.
Leo, that's Hawaiian talk because Leo is in Hawaii and not here. Don't believe him. He's not actually here. He's far, far away. But we're here to talk about something that it made me laugh. It's also sad because I've used some of these products. Piece by Ron Amadeo at Ars Technica called Google's constant product showdowns are damaging its brand. And this made me laugh. We are 91 days into the year, and so far, Google is racking up an unprecedented body count. If we just take the official shutdown dates that have already occurred in 2019, a Google-branded product, feature, or service has died on average every 9 days. Such things as Chromecast Audio, YouTube Annotations, Google Fiber, Android Things, Google's Laptop and Tablet Division, Google Allo, Spotlight Stories, the Goog.gl URL shortener. Let's see, what else? Google Inbox, Google Hangouts Classic, Google Music's migration to YouTube Music. You know, Google likes to try lots of things, and some of them work, and some of them don't, and they rethink some of them. But I have to say, this story resonated with me a little bit as somebody who has used lots of Google services over the years, and sometimes they stick around. Google Voice still works, although they don't talk about it anymore. That's a bad sign. Andy, you talk about Google a lot. You have a podcast about Android. I wanted to come to you first for this one. You know, should we get mad about Google sunsetting, to use a Californianism, so many products, or is this just the nature of the beast?
Well, you know, they only implode the building when everybody has left and hasn't come back for 2 or 3 years. So that's kind of okay. But the problem is when you have a product like Google Wave, which was innovative. It was, boy, it could have really been. It was such a paradigm shift in how you communicate with people that it could have been Slack before Slack existed, and they lost faith in it and they killed it before people outside of Google had a chance to figure out how to find the awesome in this new service. However, a lot of the stuff that was in Google Wave made it into other products, like the idea of you can have an agent that lives inside this chat window that is automatically doing simultaneous translation between you and somebody else. The idea that you can have that location can be totally irrelevant, that it will find you wherever you've asked to be found and make sure that the messages are routed to you correctly. But it really does mean that you never have that sort of savory for so many of these products that are just being launched. It's hard to develop that sort of savory experience where you will acknowledge that maybe a service is not 100% the best thing ever, but gosh, I've been using it for so long and I really, really love it. And all my friends use it. And we've developed, it's been around long enough that we've developed our entire workflow around this tool that they almost never kind of let things simmer in the pot long enough for that to happen. But it really does, it does point to kind of the limitations of having a company that gives away stuff for free. Because there's always that attitude that if we're giving this away for free, we don't really have a contract with our users. We can always pull this at any time. Whereas if any other company were to if Apple were to decide to just get rid of FaceTime, they would do the walk of shame and they would be feeling it for 2 or 3 years because of all the time they've put into this and the fact that they've run their entire business around this and this is a point of pride for them. It must be hard to be part of a product engineering group inside Google knowing that you can put your life and soul into this wonderful piece of technology that you're developing and not know if it's going to be around a year after you go into public beta. So if it becomes a signature problem for Google, you don't want to be associated with somebody who just doesn't have the sort of endurance to develop something and have so much faith in it as a company that you're willing to ride it out for year after year after year and let people find it.
Yeah, I mean, part of the issue, and we're seeing some chatter in the chat room about this too, is are people using this stuff? And sometimes these are products that Google launches with a lot of fanfare, and then nobody uses them, and you kill them. So FaceTime, people use FaceTime, so Apple probably wouldn't kill it. Ping, you know, Apple, nobody used that, and they did kill it, and they did do the walk of shame. But some of these products do get used. I keep hearing from people to this day angry about Google Reader going away. I still used Hangouts for some podcasts, but Hangouts is being shut off, the classic version of Hangouts, which is not the Slack clone that is the new version of Hangouts. And I think you make a good point. Like, okay, they're free, but part of the goal there is it's free and then you use it and then it becomes popular and then it becomes a business model, eventually something like Gmail. But why should I try this free product if I am worried that it's just going to die? And if I'm somebody building products at Google, I have that same concern.
And pretty much right now, if you're still using Google Plus, it's because you love the thing.
Yeah.
And Google being Google, they like things that have another billion users. There are probably plenty of social networks that would be happy to have however many users Google Plus still has. But for Google, it's puny. An inbox is never going to have a billion users like Gmail.
Even though it's pretty good.
Yeah. And the people who love inbox really love it. I mean, this has been going on for 5 or 6 years. When Larry Page came back to be CEO of Google again, he introduced a strategy called putting more wood behind fewer arrows, which was basically, let's make the stuff that's really popular as good as it can be and weed out the less important stuff. So it's not new, but even though Google is not quite as weird and wacky and as experimental as it once was, it still has been launching stuff like Inbox and Allo. Again, Allo, the idea was that they could compete successfully with WhatsApp and Messenger. They never came anywhere close to it. And if they can't do it, it's kind of pointless from Google's standpoint to offer Allo, even though I'm sure there are people who loved it.
Yeah, and there's an argument to be made that that is being disciplined to say, we're going to try stuff, but if it doesn't work, we're not going to just be stuck with it. We want to do something that might work, so we're going to stop doing this thing that doesn't work and move on from there.
And if they do kill Google Voice, I'll of a sudden be a lot angrier because I do use Google Voice, and I never was all that into Inbox or Plus.
Right.
Yeah, that's how they do things, right? A lot of what they do is based on real market feedback. And so you go out, you launch it, you have people try it out, and then see if you get critical mass or not. That's the way to do it versus, the way that Apple does it, where they go out not to try it. It actually, you know, they go out with a service and then it might or might not work. We're talking about news earlier. If it were Google doing News Plus, I'm sure that would have been like some kind of beta version coming out, and then you'll have the real product further down the line when they had more content that was optimized, but that's not the way Apple does things. I do think that, as all of you have implied, the fact that consumers don't pay for it makes it a little bit more okay to kind of swallow the fact that the product, even if you liked it so much, was canceled. But it's interesting that a lot of times this comes in all shape or form. Think about, you know, it can be the product that is canceled or the product that changes forms as far as going from free to paid. What happened to Flickr, for instance, was something that a lot of people were really upset about because a lot of photographers were using Flickr. And so the changes that came to the service were something that they were very upset. This week, there was news from Microsoft deciding that they're no longer going to sell books within their App Store. And if you not only, you know, they're not going to sell books, so you can't buy them anymore. But if you did buy books in the past, because the books were delivered to you via a web browser, you no longer have those books. And you paid for those. You know, so maybe you thought about it, that if it was a browser, it wasn't really yours because you couldn't download it on your device. But I don't know that for a lot of people, that little step clicked. So now you feel like they took your money and you're left with nothing.
I think Microsoft is giving everybody essentially refunds for all the books they bought, which is... you know, that's some money back in your pocket, but it's still frustration if you bought those
books. I thought
books.
The refund were for pre-orders.
Were
and,
they?
And book. That's what I read, but I might be totally mistaken.
I don't know. Yeah, it would very much stink if you bought something, even if it was just a license to it, to have it digitally and then just have the vendor say, sorry, it's gone. Yeah. That would be that'd be not good.
You know, that brings up something that I didn't even think about. That if there's an app that I really, really like for my MacBook and the company goes out of business, they stop supporting it, so long as Apple doesn't do anything to the operating system that causes that app to stop working, I can still use that old copy of FileMaker or whatever out of business company app that I've used. I can continue to use Nisus Writer as long as I want to use it. Whereas when you put all of your workflow and all of your creativity into an app that is web-based and they decide to just flip a switch and shut down that web server, you don't have that app anymore. And it's we shouldn't understate how big a disruption it is when all the machinery that you've put into your office to make your money or to just be creative suddenly disappears just like that. How hard it is to find another art app, or how hard it is to find another spreadsheet or word processor or project manager that works that way. So if this causes people to have less faith in Google, the question is going to be, is that lack of faith more powerful than your desire to never, ever, ever, ever pay for electrons ever under any circumstances, which is a feature that Google is always more than happy to provide in spades.
And I have a follow-up. Indeed, Microsoft is going to give you money back for your pre-orders and for all of your purchases in that store. And if you marked up any of those books, they'll give you an additional $25 credit, because presumably you're going to have to download your notes or copy them somewhere else. That's doing the right thing, but still, that's a service that you were relying on that is just going to go away.
Oh my God, it's the bizarro world version of the college textbook industry. Yeah. We will give you 100% of your money back, exactly what you paid, and if the more you use them, the more we will pay you. Good
heavens. Bookstore pays you. That's I didn't know I was going to do Yakov Smirnoff. Let's talk about...
We're all delighted with the surprise.
Australia has passed legislation that will punish social media companies for failing to remove abhorrent violent material from their platforms. Obviously, this law was opposed by the tech industry and is one of the strongest laws, most likely a world first in Australia. I was thinking about this in terms of some other stories that we saw this week about YouTube letting toxic videos run rampant on its service. A Bloomberg story about that, how there were lots of proposals, but in the end, the goal was engagement, and longer videos and videos that were perhaps toxic in terms of their content did do well in terms of the engagement metrics they were looking at. And it's not not a great situation. I think these stories are linked in terms of these social media companies trying to prioritize the wrong thing. And I don't love the idea of governments coming in and saying, well, we've got a solution and it's this regulation. We've seen how most laws that are created aren't really created with knowledge of technology in mind. But at the same time, it's hard to argue that there aren't some serious problems in terms of how these companies are prioritizing what they leave on their services and what they take off of their services.
Yeah, I think it's pretty scary when you have laws like this, including laws that what was happening in the copyright directive that the EU passed a couple of weeks ago,
right.
That when you're – it's not just a problem of being so broad as to include everything. When you have this new Australian law that says that, number one, as a service provider, you are responsible. Number two, you're responsible for doing this in a timely fashion. And these are so vague that – not only does it make it really, really hard to comply with these rules, the knee-jerk reaction is going to be to stifle free speech, to make sure that if we don't know that this post is absolutely as pure as ivory snow, we are not going to allow this to be posted. And also, how does that help someone who needs to report from the field all the way down to someone who just wants to share these crocheting tips that they found useful as they're learning how to crochet? It's the other big problem is that I just don't think that a lot of these laws appreciate how difficult this problem is. It's so easy for wetware, for a human brain, to look at a piece of posted content and say this is obviously Nazi material. This is obviously white supremacist material. It is really, really difficult for an algorithm to do that. And when you have the volume of content being uploaded every single hour on a service like YouTube, you have to have a system that allows these companies to try to fight the battle instead of having to withdraw for fear of being sued out of existence every other Thursday.
I mean, everything Andy said is true, but I also think that the likes of YouTube and Facebook have not done themselves any favors because there's stuff they could have done, which they have not. And so even before you get to the truly difficult questions, and the things that are truly difficult to do with technology, they could have done more. And so they leave themselves looking like they don't take it seriously enough, which they probably don't, which means the laws are more likely to come along. And some of these laws already exist. Germany has this law that basically says you have to quickly take down anything bad anybody says about anybody on the internet. So, yeah, they're difficult questions, but they're also relatively easy ones that these companies have not handled well.
It's certainly true, and Andy mentioned the copyright directives. You end up with this chilling effect where it becomes very hard for companies. They have to do a lot of filtering, which might lead you to over-filtering, you know, right? Taking out the bad stuff and also some stuff that's perfectly fine. I mean, I know somebody who has a podcast about knitting, I want to say, and had her Facebook group removed for, you know, basically being a bad actor. And I'm like, well, but it's knitting in Sweden. It's not. And
that
yet,
tea cozy was a false
maybe
flag
they were
operation.
Doing ugly
I know
sweaters.
It.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, knitters, you know, my wife is a knitter. I think knitters are generally okay, but you never know. They could be up to something. But that makes people angry, right? But when you pass a law that says you are going to be in huge trouble if you don't filter everything, one of the things that will happen is all these platforms that will accept sort of anything from the internet, anything that comes across the transom and post it, are going to become much less functional. And that is a good thing in terms of really gross, awful stuff. But it's a bad thing if you're somebody who is used to having your voice be heard about something that is potentially much more innocuous. And it also creates a barrier for anybody else who wants to create any business or service on the internet, because only the biggest companies are going to be able to hire staffs of people and build complicated algorithms to scan everything to make sure that it's okay. And that's the other problem with stuff like this. Carolina, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, and especially as a, not just from a tech perspective, but as a mother, of an 11-year-old who happens to spend some time on YouTube. And yes, we have the age limits, and you know, we're careful about what she watches, but it's so easy to go from an innocuous search to content that is clearly not for her. So I agree with everything that you guys have said. It is a concern when government starts to come in with very little understanding of how the world is in 2019 and try and dictate what can and cannot be done. I also agree with Harry that it doesn't feel that monitoring and improving the health of social media in general has been a priority for a lot of these companies. And so something has to change. You know, if the CEOs and whoever doesn't feel accountable for providing a service that is as best as they can, with the understanding that it will never be perfect, because I'm sure that they, you know, they can paddle as much as a duck does underwater, but still have somebody ahead of them, you should feel that they're trying. And personally, I don't feel that. I feel that there's more time focused on AI features and improvements for their benefit than not. I was listening to someone say, you know, that they know so much and they can be so good at certain things, and yet something that is, and Twitter, I think, is a great example of that, right? Of people being suspended for something that obviously it wasn't worth a suspension, and people being very abusive, and yet, you know, Twitter not finding anything wrong with what they tweeted. So I don't know if he's AI, I don't know if he's human, because even from a human perspective, people have different ideas of what is right and what is wrong. But something has to be done. And if it's not a government level law or dictate, who's going to take that responsibility? And I don't have an answer for it. I do think that we as consumers should demand better.
Yeah, and the fact is, you know, the laws are often 10 years behind and crafted by people who don't understand technology. Yeah. The services don't seem to be showing as much desire to decrease engagement in order to increase quality and get some of this stuff off of their services. And we're left with this kind of conundrum of, is the threat of being legislated against enough to make the services behave better? Is there a way to create some legislation that threads that needle and gets them to do a reasonable job of this? I don't know. I mean, in the U.S., the track record with legislation involving copyright and involving safe harbor provisions and all sorts of other things that we've seen in the last 20 years, track record is not good in terms of those laws actually doing what they thought they were going to do. So not to leave you on a downer note there, but I think this is a big challenge for the tech industry as a whole. We need to move on, and I need to scare you with scary security stories of the week. I promised you there would be some frightening things coming up. But first, somebody who's not frightening at all, because we love him, it's Leo.
Hey, thank you, Jason. And on we go with the show in just a minute, but first a word from Capterra. I am, because of the radio show, I think I am the point man for a lot of people who are, I know it when they call. They work for a business and the boss has said, we need better software, find it. And so they call me. They say, Leo, I need a CMS, or I need a CRM, or I need a email marketing tool, or I need a social media marketing tool, or I need... Sometimes I get people call. I run a dentist's office. You got any good dental office software? I don't know. But I don't want to send them to Google. That's even worse. Google dental office management software. You'll get just a pile of results with no way to figure out what's right. I've got a much better way. Don't call me. Don't go Google it. Go to Capterra. It's the search engine for business software. And I love it. Over 700 categories, too. I mean, everything you could ever need, from project management, email marketing, yoga studio management. It's all there. Dog groomer. It's all there. And best of all, 800,000 reviews and counting from actual users. They're very careful. They vet the reviews. Those are people who use the program. So what you do is you go to Capterra, you find the category you're looking for. They'll give you check boxes for features. You check the boxes of the stuff you've got to have. It'll show you all the programs that have that. You can compare them side by side if you want. You can read all the reviews. This is the best way to research business software. Now, what I just described to you, you'd probably pay $10, $20, $30, $50 a month for, and I'm sure you're expecting to. So you're maybe going to be a little skeptical when I tell you Capterra is free, and I mean free. There's no upsell. That's it. That's why millions of people use it every month. It's free. Go to capterra.com/twit. You'll find the right tools to make an informed decision for your business. Sometimes people are using old business software, you know. That's why so many people still use Windows XP. They got an old program that won't work on anything more modern. Get with the times. Go to capterra.com/twit. Find the best modern software for your business. Capterra.com/twit. Capterra is software selection simplified. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Tech. And we thank you for supporting us by using that URL. Capterra. Just check it out. It's amazing. Capterra.com/twit. Now on with the show.
Spooky, scary security. Not a podcast, but it could be. Instead, it's going to be a segment here. I can't tell you how many stories I found this week, just this week, while looking up headlines for Twit that chilled me to the bone. Perhaps the one that did it most, and this was a week ago today, and it's the story of hacking Tesla's auto drive with stickers. You love stickers. You can put them on your laptop. They're great. But in this case, small stickers were used to create what is called a fake lane attack, which is not a phrase I ever wanted to learn, but now I've heard it. They were able to stick stickers on a street so that the Tesla automatic pilot thought the lane was shifting to the left when it wasn't and got the Tesla to move. I don't like this story. I don't like the fact that some guy with stickers can make Teslas veer into the wrong lane, but I guess that's where we live now, is we live in a world where a sticker pack could be used to hijack a car. I'm just saying. It can happen.
That's just great. So not only can I not afford a Tesla, and not only am I going to be like jeopardized by people who use autopilot like they can take a nap, but also I got to be jeopardized by people putting stickers on the road. I feel as though I need to buy a Tesla just so I can return the fire.
Yeah, it is scary if it's like, you know, somebody's out there putting stickers and you got to dodge Teslas that are coming from who knows what direction because the stickers are there. It's a true story. I think Tesla has already said that they're working on a fix to this. And I think it's good that security researchers, if that was who did this, are working on stuff like this. But also it just is disturbing, the idea that we've trained cars to drive themselves in certain circumstances. But then if mischievous people put stickers in the wrong place, it all is ruined. It's all for naught.
This isn't Dennis the Menace. We can save really, really bad jerks who want to kill people.
Yes, exactly. The worst jerks.
All the people who are doing this are attempting to disclose this problem before the jerks figure it out.
And indeed.
Much better to have a researcher find it out than to learn about it when somebody does it in a major city.
For sure.
And presumably there will be problems akin to this that we do learn about when somebody does it, and it's extremely effective.
Yes, and I like the fact that, you know, Tesla is going to do some analysis and they're going to figure out how to combat it. And I just don't like the idea that I hadn't really thought about the fact that some reflective stickers placed on a roadway can create a false lane. And that's your fake lane attack that I don't want to know about. How about this one? Speaking of people,
in fairness, I would be concerned if you thought about it. Just saying.
Yeah. I don't like it. Okay, so let's go one better, worse. Fake cancer in CT scans created by malware to trick radiologists. Researchers in Israel created malware that would make false cancerous nodules show up on CT scans and in MRIs. Again, I'm not quite sure why, but I think the idea here is that you could potentially do an attack on a country's health system where suddenly all of their health scanners would be unreliable.
Or one example given was you want to drive a politician out of a race. You trick them into thinking they have cancer when they don't, and they get out.
Right. They used the example of Hillary Clinton having when she fainted, and there were all these rumors going around. And what if they had attacked her data at that moment and made her or somebody like her think that they were had a tumor somewhere, and they drop out of the race? Yeah.
It really is just a major. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, this is kind of going back to what I was saying earlier. We can do all these things, and yet we cannot solve the problem, violent content on social media. Go figure.
Well, you see, it's there's so many industries that they need to have that moment of a wake-up call where they realize that you're so excited about this amazing 3D imaging technology that you don't spend any time on the 1993 technology to make sure that these systems are secure from an outside attack. And you're really, really proud of this autopilot system that can lead to self-driving cars. You don't decide that, why don't we apply basic principles to make sure that an outside party cannot take control of the car and steer the car into a bridge abutment. And that's the commonality to all these stories. It's not that it's disappointing that pranksters who are looking out for the lulls can put stickers on a road and trick a Tesla into going to oncoming traffic. That's what you learn when you keep developing brand new technology. But when you learn that other people haven't been able to get into these systems from the outside and take over the car, it seems as though there's a way to develop a computer on board the car that is highly resistant to that sort of attack. Another story that was coming out belatedly the past couple of weeks is how personal data that gets onto these onboard navigation systems and control systems isn't being stored in a secure way. So if you buy a wrecked Tesla, you can get every piece of information pretty much about that person who used that Tesla just by pulling it off of the storage of the device that was built into it. And similar to the reasons why I keep a Bluetooth speaker with me when I travel and I have to rent a car, because I know that if I actually use the built-in Bluetooth, it's going to immediately suck all my contacts into the center console, and I don't know how good the center console is going to be at erasing this stuff when I disconnect and tell it to forget about my phone. So there's so many So simple things that are drilled into our heads if we've ever had a one-hour seminar or read one article about data privacy and security that just don't seem to be being followed on these systems that we're entrusting so much information and so much of our safety to. It's very disappointing.
Yeah, a related story to that is Bloomberg reported this week that Facebook user data for third-party apps. Now, we already heard about this with Cambridge Analytica, but this was a new one, which is several of those third-party apps had taken all of that Facebook user data and put it in plain text on a publicly accessible Amazon server. Yep. So, again, like, you could have one layer of security, and then there's another layer of security, and then somebody in the chain does something stupid, and there's all your data. It's out there.
Facebook had already tightened up that stuff, but the horse was already out of the barn.
Right.
Because in the old days, if you were Facebook's partner, they'd give you the data and you were responsible for taking care of it.
Right. And not everybody. With great power comes great responsibility, people. But back in those days, not so much. So just plain text of all your friends out on Amazon. I do want to mention iced tea. Not the guy. The drink, the lovely beverage. Who doesn't like iced tea?
Oh, God, what are hackers doing to our Lipton?
Well, Arizona Beverages, makers of the Arizona iced tea product that so many of the kids like today, they told all their workers this week, don't touch your computers, don't turn them on, don't even look at them, because they're infected by ransomware. More than 200 servers and network computers were told, what a way to start the day, what a Monday. Your network was hacked and encrypted. And they brought in, it took them 5 days. I love this. It took them 5 days before they brought in incident responders to handle this. I like to imagine that the IT staff was just like huddled in a back room somewhere being like, what do we do, man? What do we do? For 5 days before they realized that they needed to take care of that situation. So if you're thirsty. I'm sure that the iced tea hasn't been encrypted. I'm sure the iced tea itself is fine, but all of their data has been encrypted. That's a bad day. That's a bad week if you're the IT guy at Arizona Iced Tea. Nobody has iced tea related things. Well, then I'm going to move on to sandwiches. I'm going to ruin sandwiches for you now because 2 million credit cards for restaurants, including Buca di Beppo, Planet Hollywood, and Earl of Sandwich, a tasty sandwich shop that I go to when I'm in San Jose, California. My credit card's probably been exposed. This is Earl Enterprises that owns these restaurants. And they've had another large data breach. So if you like sandwiches, the Earl of Sandwich, if you like the giant meatball the size of your head at Buca di Beppo, check your credit cards.
Yeah. This is why this is such a good time for Apple to be introducing the Apple credit card, to put the certain features front and center, saying that you can have like a burner credit card number that is absolutely good as a MasterCard. And then as soon as you get back from your week-long vacation, you can absolutely destroy it so that no one will ever be able to use that number again without having to sign up for a new card or get a new whatever, a new PIN sent to you. These are features that are on other bank cards, but banks are going to have to up their game because it's the ability to create burner credit card numbers has got to be more easy for them than to actually make sure that all transactions are stored securely and not, I don't know, on a Windows XP machine that's with a Gateway logo on it.
And getting back to the iced tea folks for
a
moment.
Sorry, I didn't want to skip over the iced tea.
I mean, it sounds like not that they deserved for it to happen, but they did. They were running like ancient software and they had not been patching it. And there is probably an alternate universe where this didn't happen because they were on top of things before they had to be.
Yes, the New Mexico iced tea is fine right. In a parallel universe. But here in ours, yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? Computers, it's great. You know, I remember when not everybody had a computer and not everybody was on the internet. But now everybody's got a computer. Everybody's on the internet. Not everybody who's taking all that data is thinking about security as much as they should. That's the truth.
And these things keep happening. Equifax is a classic example. Equifax didn't patch its server.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
It could have.
It's going to keep happening until we have enough people who are trained well enough to think about this and enough managers who let them do what they need to do. And in some cases, as Harry pointed out, it's about spending the money to upgrade your systems. That's part of it, too. If you've got some old system that has a known exploit and nobody will fund you to replace it, then you're just going to sit there and be vulnerable with customer data, potentially, which is not good. I had one more. Go ahead, Andy.
Just to quickly, I think one of the huge problems, though, is that there's absolutely no consequences for these companies outside of a PR consequence when they have a massive data breach like this that turns out to be because they were absolutely inept at protecting customer data. I mean, I keep thinking about how there was a time where there was almost no incentive 100 years ago to make sure that if you're a butcher shop, you're selling meat that isn't spoiled, that if you're selling flour that is not contaminated with all kinds of things that you would that are present in warehouses by the animals that infest the places, but you don't want to ever eat or drink. There's just no reason for them to. There's no punishment for them if they find out that they're selling food or selling a drug that is making people sick. Until we kind of got fed up as a society and said, well, guess what? We're creating an entirely new government-level administration that doesn't try to regulate you into existence, but simply says that you are absolutely on the hook if people die because something that you advertise as a cough syrup is actually poisoning people with lead and mercury. And I think that that's the point that we have to get to very, very quickly, to say that if you want to, again, keep running your data on a Windows XP device as a point-of-sale terminal, if you want to have things on an open, if you want to let your research department take data that's supposed to be in a really, really secure server and put it someplace where it's really, really easy and handy for you to get to, but is available to everybody else, go ahead and do that. But you're not going to just simply be offering your customers 6 months worth of free credit report tracking. You are going to be hit with huge, huge penalties as a result. That is the only thing that is going to assure that our data is getting the sort of security and attention that it's supposed to be getting.
I'll sign up for that. One more bad story to share with you.
You dressed in black for a reason, didn't you?
That's right. I have the sad duty to report
you. You're the Lee
you.
Van Cleef of podcast hosting.
This one, you've probably already heard the story. I just want to point out again, a woman walked into Mar-a-Lago, the winter White House. The president of the United States was nearby. She said she wanted to go swimming. She had four smartphones, a laptop, and a USB key containing malware. I don't really have any. I mean, first off, it's great. There was actually a receptionist who was like, wait a second, this seems like a bad idea, and stopped her. But I just like the idea of four cell phones, a laptop, and a USB key with malware in it. What could she be doing? I'm sure it was just a misunderstanding. I'm sure it was just a misunderstanding.
Yeah. She was actually, I think she was, the front desk said that I am a member. I really am. I just came in to use the pool and they thought they'd recognized her name from someplace. So they waved her through. It was the Secret Service that said, we took a look at her things and she doesn't seem to have a swimsuit. And now she's saying that she's there for some sort of a China trade conference that's happening later tonight. And she wanted to get pictures of the area to make sure that she knew where the reception desk, where the sign in desk was supposed to be. But yeah, see, there's. This is problematic.
I love the swimming. No, I just need to use the pool. Yeah. I love that. Just throw that in there. I don't have a swimsuit, but that's a poker player. I need to use the pool. That's it.
At least you didn't say golfing.
In our chat room, Stoic Squirrel pointed out Leo has four cell phones. Do we know that Leo's in Hawaii? Do we know that for sure? Is he at Mar-a-Lago right now? Possibly.
I'm just offended that you tried to get around the system. If you want to get personal data from the president, you're going to have to sign up for $500,000 membership, just like every other lobbyist and international figure. There's a system. There's a reason why that system works.
I'm just here to use the pool. Just here for the pool. All right. Speaking of Leo, we have one more sponsor for Leo to read, and it will happen right now.
We'll have more with Jason Snell and the team and just a bit more Twit coming up. I'm sorry I'm not there. I wish I were. It sounds like fun. Oh, I know I'm having a horrible time in the sun and fun. It's Hawaii. I'm on the beach. I know. It's just murder. I'll be back next week, I promise. Meanwhile. Meanwhile, I'd like to talk to the IT team in your business. IT is the heart of any business these days, really. I mean, that's where it all happens. Here in any business, thanks to the cloud and all of this, IT teams are empowering business. And who empowers IT teams? Atlassian, the collaboration software company that empowers IT teams all over the world. Staying competitive in an increasingly cloud-based world means you have to have IT teams that are at the top of their form. They can plan, they can execute, they're fast, they're agile, they're smart. And I'm going to underline this because it's important to me. They know how to communicate with their stakeholders. They can coordinate between ops and software development teams. They're good communicators, and that's what Atlassian does. Atlassian supports IT at the center of your operation. And you know probably Jira, right? That's the brand everybody knows with Atlassian. That's the first way I experienced Atlassian. We use Jira for developing our new website. It's a great way. Now we use it to keep track of all the projects around the studio. We know who's responsible, what stage it's at, what they're doing. And, of course, there's that great satisfying feeling when you move that task over to the completed column. Jira is really the best way to manage complex projects. But the thing I like about Jira is it works with another Atlassian product called Confluence. And because it's so tightly integrated, it makes it very easy for our team, our IT guys, our studio staff and so forth, to document what they did. And documentation to me is also important so they can pass on their knowledge, right? So that everybody understands what's going on. There's no mystery. This is what kind of the backbone of Atlassian. I think sometimes people think it's just for developers. It's not. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all types, all sizes, from DevOps to Agile to IT apps to Ops to ITSM and whatever you've got in your building. They provide that technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support exactly the kind of change you want to propel your business. So I mentioned Jira and Confluence. If you've got a code database, there's the great Bitbucket. But also Opsgenie, if you need to keep track of incidents and coordinate response efforts. They got Trello now. I mean, there's a bunch of tools. I can go on and on. Here's the deal. Go to Atlassian.com/IT and choose the tools. It's right for your current framework. And you can trust that as you grow, they will grow with you. As your needs expand, there will be an Atlassian tool just right for that. And because it integrates seamlessly, especially with Confluence and Jira, it means that your communication's improved. Your team isn't leaving the platform to make a note of things. It's all in one place. Atlassian's tools for your IT team are easy and free to try right now at Atlassian.com/IT. Get there. Find out what Atlassian offering is right for your team. Atlassian.com/IT. We thank Atlassian so much for giving us those tools, for supporting This Week in Tech, and I thank you for supporting us by visiting Atlassian.com/IT. All right, I'm not going to take any more of your time. Back to the show. Jason Snell, thank you so much. I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Boy, Leo, man, you're killing me with that Hawaii stuff. I'm here in California. Rainy, terrible. Okay, it's not that bad in California. It's fine. One last story. We're on the downhill slide now, but this is a story that I had to talk about. It involves Steven Spielberg and, yes, the Department of Justice. And it goes like this. Steven Spielberg has come out as saying that he doesn't think that Netflix movies should be eligible for Academy Awards, even if they jump through the hoops of award eligibility and show the movies for a week in L.A. and New York in order to be eligible. Steven Spielberg actually told somebody at ITV News in an interview that he considers any movie on Netflix a TV movie. I've seen Roma. please do not tell me that is a TV movie. Come on, man. Steven Spielberg, who, by the way, 2 weeks ago stood on stage
exactly
at Apple's campus to extol the virtues of his technically TV show, yes, on a streaming service at Apple. Apple's going to have movies, too. Presumably, if they screen them in the right theaters, they'll be eligible for an Oscar. Anyway, Netflix shot back and said one of the things they always say, which is so many more people have access to Netflix than often can see, especially smaller movies, in movie theaters. So there are lots of reasons that Netflix thinks they are film-friendly, and they're making movies and funding movies that otherwise might not even get made. Well, Spielberg said he was going to go to the Academy and say, they shouldn't be eligible for Oscars. We should just ban Netflix from being eligible for Oscars. Which got a letter sent to him and the Academy by the Department of Justice saying, you know, if a bunch of companies who compete with a different company conspire to kick them out of awards and that therefore leads to their business being harmed in some way and them making less money than normal, that's collusion and illegal. And you might want to rethink things a little bit. Now, I think this is sort of silly that it's escalated to the point where there's a letter from the Department of Justice. But then again, I think it's kind of silly that Steven Spielberg thinks Roma is a TV movie, because it's not. And I love Steven Spielberg and I love his movies. But, well, I didn't like Hook. I think Hook is really bad. But I love him in general. And, you know, what is the story here? Andy, help me out here. Bring reason to this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really dogmatic idea that if you have a movie that is not being made for a huge projection screen to be a shared experience with strangers, then it's not technically a movie, which dogmatically, okay, that's fine, but it shouldn't exclude a movie, as you make such a good point, Roma, from being considered for an Oscar. A movie that, by the way, was screened in 150 U.S. theaters and something and many more outside of the United States. There's a very, very simple rule for how you make a movie eligible. You simply have to run it for 1 week in a theater in L.A. or New York during a certain period of the day in an advertised sort of screening. But they actually did it as a real release. release as basically as a really major release of an important foreign movie from an important director, which is what it was. The only complaints that they make that might have some sort of teeth to it is the idea that a Netflix movie or a streaming movie has an advantage over a traditional theatrical movie because the current rules don't establish a window of exclusivity for the theatrical release. So they can start their 1 week qualifying run in LA. And then I think like on that exact same day, as soon as it's screened once, they can now open it up. They can now have it drop on their streaming service, which means that whereas a traditional Hollywood movie is going to be released for home streaming months after its release and maybe only barely before Oscar season starts, essentially everybody who could be voting on this or nominating movies could have been watching this movie since September, October, November. That might give them an advantage. Again, that's a thing to discuss, but the fact of the matter is that I think Netflix's argument is the one that's more important, that the fact of the matter is that you have all the movies that are being released, the big blockbusters that are happening this month, they're not just going to one screen and one multiplex, they're taking over every single, if you got the multiplex that has 20 screens on it, the Marvel movie has 6 screens plus both the IMAX screens, the DC movies might have another 2 or 3 screens, got a Transformer movie. So as a result, the movies that traditionally are Oscar bait, or at least are more get more attention from awards, just can't find a place to run and can't find a place to get that kind of attention. Whereas Netflix and Hulu and hopefully Apple are going to give these smaller movies. But even there, the argument can kind of go a little bit south. Martin Scorsese's next movie with Robert De Niro, with everybody, is going to be costing about $200 million. And it is a direct to Netflix release with a theatrical release for qualification. So, but I hope that if they make any changes to the rules, it isn't something that makes a movie like Roma harder to be recognized. This was, we forget that this was like the first best director, not just best foreign film director, but the best director of any movie last year went to a foreign movie. The first time that Mexico won best foreign film. And you can't deny that this was a movie that was you can't say that this was a movie made for phone screens. This was a real darn movie.
Yeah, it really was.
Emotionally, I have to say, even though I feel guilty about it, I'm sort of on Spielberg's side. First of all, I think you taking the Oscars seriously is kind of silly, but I do but I do sort of like this like 115-year-old communal experience of going out somewhere and sharing an experience with other people. It's quite a different experience than sitting at home watching a movie. I think it's something valuable. I can understand why Steven Spielberg also thinks it's valuable and is a little bit defensive about it.
Yeah, I hear that. I think in the end, yes, you could argue then why not nominate like a season of TV for an Oscar at that point.
Right. Should, yeah. Should.
At the same time, you know, the work of art isn't any different based on exactly where it premieres or if it runs for a week. And that, I think that's part of the problem, right? Is it sounds like they're trying to rig the rules in order to get Netflix out as opposed to trying to encourage. Now, what the Cannes Film Festival did is they said this movie needs to run and not be on streaming for a month in French theaters or we won't consider it. And that's a much harsher rule, but it's fair if you really want to say that that is the rule that's required, but then every movie would be required.
Yeah, why doesn't the Oscars just tighten it up and say it's not just a week, it's 6 weeks or whatever? Although I guess there are theatrical releases who never make it to 6 weeks, probably.
That's true, but they wouldn't be eligible for an Oscar then. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the challenge. But
it's also really, really silly because one of the problems that the Oscars telecast has had year after year is that the movies that are being nominated are movies that the general public just has never, ever seen. And as they're turning to streaming services to see feature movies more and more, they are sort of turning their backs on a way to revitalize the awards to make it seem more accessible and important to absolutely everybody. I mean, there was a time when the Emmys would say that no, you're a cable TV show. You're not qualified for an Emmy, and they had the Cable Ace Awards for that instead. And at some point, somebody slapped the Emmy organization really, really hard, or they slapped themselves really hard, and saying there's no way that The Sopranos is not television, and we're all seeing this through a television screen. They should be allowed to compete for the regular Emmys as well. It hasn't seemed to have hurt the Emmy Awards at all. This is just silly.
Carolina, do you have opinions about Spielberg or about Hook?
Well, I'm not sure about Hook. I don't think I can share those. I do think that clearly for Spielberg, it's like this is unfair until I make a movie for Apple and then that's okay. But if we're looking at, changing the rules, how about going the other way and shortening even more the gap between the theater and the streaming services or if people still buy them, Blu-rays and so forth. Because I totally hear you, Jason, when you say that smaller movies just don't get the same airtime at the theaters. We were in the winter, we were looking at The Hate U Give, which is a great movie on the back of a great book. And it was in the theater near us for one day, because it was a time where there were big releases coming out and those were taking all the theaters inside the AMC close to us. And that's the point. Like, Captain Marvel comes out and there are seven screening that take over the whole theater. So it's tough for certain movies, smaller movies. And at the same time, I think that although I agree it's a great experience to go to the cinema and as a family, we do that quite often, there are a lot of people that don't have access to a theater and or physically don't like going to a theater because they might have either disability issues or anxiety issues or whatever else. So I think there's, you shouldn't be denied access to great content based on whether or not you can get yourself to a theater.
Yep, I agree with that. It's yes, awards are silly. They are silly. Awards for art are extra silly. But at the same time, I do have a problem with this idea that just the a business-based mechanism of delivery is the only reason. But Harry's got a great point. If you wanted to create, as the Academy, an incentive to have movies stay in movie theaters for longer than they do, you could change the rules for everybody and make them keep those movies in the theater longer. And you know what? Netflix for Roma would have done whatever it took in order to get that movie up for an Oscar. And I think it deserved what it won. And I thought it was the best picture of the year, but I don't get a vote. I'm not in the Academy. So I'm not allowed.
One quick note, probably the reason why the DOJ letter came when it did was that the Academy has an annual meeting that happens, I think, in the next couple of weeks, in which they just routinely discuss proposed rule changes. So it's probably why they decided to boot off that letter. Also because I think that the DOJ has its own Oscar picks that they're trying. the DOJ office Oscar pool, the integrity has to be maintained.
It's a nice award you got here. It would be a shame if something happened to it, like a DOJ investigation. I can't wait to see the Steven Spielberg movie about the investigation into Steven Spielberg by the Justice Department. It'll be released on Netflix, so up for an Emmy, I guess. All right, that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Twit, the Leo-less Twit, but Leo will be back last week. Before we go, I want to thank my panelists for coming and helping a guest host out because, this isn't my seat, this isn't my desk. Harry McCracken, who I have worked with for very long back. We were the original Mac and PC back in the day. Thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure, Jason.
And people can find you at Fast Company?
Fast Company, at Harry McCracken on Twitter. And I would be giving my Google Plus account now, except no point.
Moment of silence, moment of silence. Andy Inatko, who I have worked with for so long. You are a beloved technology pundit and columnist. Where can people find you and your stuff?
You, as usual, if you can spell my last name, I-H-N as in Nancy, A-T as in Tom, K-O. You can see me on Instagram, Twitter, and on my blog at anatgo.com, where I usually post stuff and links to where I can be published. I'm also the tech contributor to WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and usually I'm on for about a half hour every Friday or every other Friday. It depends on how nasty the rest of the world has been. Sometimes I get bumped for that.
And, of course, MacBreak Weekly right here and Material.
Sorry, yes, MacBreak Weekly and the Material podcast on Relay FM. Thank you for finding some time, Jason, between your morning podcast on Relay and your late afternoon podcast on Relay to use your usual, like, public hygiene time to make sure that you have some time to do another podcast for another network
it's,
in between.
You know, it's 11 a.m. It says keep tabs on Andy on my schedule, so I make sure I know where your movements at all times.
You
and
know,
see
if
where you have
if
to
you're
be.
Gonna if you're gonna have a parole officer, it may as well be one of your oldest and dearest friends.
Excellent. Carolina Milanese, thank you so much for being on this this video program. Where can people find your stuff?
Thank you for having me, first of all. This was fun. And people can find me on techpinions.com. I have a weekly column there, on Twitter, as you have me, at @Cara_Milanese. And as of this week, if you're interested specifically in education and diversity in tech, you can find me on my new website, The Heart of Tech.
Excellent. And thanks to everybody out there for listening and watching this edition of TWiT. I hear some splashing in the distance. Leo is getting out of the ocean and will be making his way back. But until then, goodbye, everyone. Another TWiT is in the can.
This is amazing.